I have in my hand the programme of the night we're about to talk about, Shamrock Rovers versus Manchester United at Dalymount Park. And McGarry, you've brought in the programme some fascinating stuff on it, including at the very back, the there's an extra couple of songs I didn't spot there, but the community singing, sponsored by Dublin Evening Mail, containing Around the World, The More We Are Together, Keep Your Sunny Side Up, some beauts in there, and a cracking ad by Tato, Public Opinion Demands Tato. Added enjoyment with your refreshment. It's a free plug for Tato.
Be careful with that. You should be wearing white gloves, I think.
Yeah, I know.
It goes
yeah.
for about €75 on eBay.
Yeah, got to be
just
careful.
I got that from my my aunt's husband was a Bohemians fan. We always had great chats, especially when this time of year at Christmas when you go out to visit him about the League of Ireland. And he forgave me being a Shamrock Rovers fan, but he died maybe 6 or 7 years ago. And a couple of months after the funeral, my aunt gave me this match programme, which she said that she reckoned that Billy would prefer me to have. It wasn't something that she was going to get much use out of. I wouldn't...
Fair play to you for not selling it on. Because I was going to bring up a little bit down the line the story of the individual who had the... Did you see the football from that night?
No.
So essentially there was a signed football from all the Manchester United players, or from a large chunk of the Manchester United players, and obviously a fair few of them passed away after. And it was going around, I think, for like €6,000. It's one of those massive, sort of heavy brown balls.
Oh, yeah.
Covered in priceless autographs. There was a little description in it. I think it was like one of the Rovers players, you know, relatives down the line was selling it. It was just on top of a fridge somewhere, and he flogged it on, which is outrageous. Should be in a museum. But he lists in it that it's like, oh, you can't inflate it but at the moment because of the splint in it, but it can be fixed. And you're like, you're not going to inflate, you're not going to have a kick around with that thing, like, absolutely ruin it. Are you guys collectors of anything?
Having got that programme, I have a couple
I wondered.
A couple other, like, Shamrock Rovers against Schalke, and...
The fact that you let me handle it probably shows that you're not an avid collector like that, though. You're not too worried about grubby-handed individuals like myself ruining it.
No, but probably my favourite one is I have the Shamrock Rovers Botev Plovdiv Cup Winners' Cup program from 62-63, which I got online. But some people are really big into it. But I have a few of them. Like, I would always buy a match program at every game I go to. But I kind of get to the end of the year and I tip them out. I keep all the Rovers ones because I self-promotion, you know, writing all of them as well. So I have a few of those programs. But yeah, having the Manchester United Shamrock Rovers one from 57-58 is a nice one to have because it's the very first Rovers game in Europe.
Dave, you don't strike me as a collector in that you hold very little precious and dear from the time I've known you.
And that I look like I don't have any possessions. no, I still have absolutely everything I've ever owned. I just don't collect it. It's not in any sort of...
it's more of a hoarding, like...
Yeah, it's kind of fuck it on the floor and that's about it, you know.
Newspapers everywhere in Dave's house. You know, he's like, when Dave dies, it'll be one of us. It'll be on the television.
Yeah.
I still have... I have programs from every... More or less every game I've reported on over the past, like, 4 years. So if anybody ever needs a program, I probably have it.
The few things I ever had... More when I was younger, I had a mini football signed by Damien Duff, which I think actually did end up getting kicked around a little bit, which is a bit of a shame. But also, my dad once came back with a signed picture of Dirk Kuyt that he won in a raffle in one of the local pubs. And I asked him how they'd gotten Dirk Kuyt's signature, because it was like in Clondalkin. And he said he was pretty sure it was one of his mates that signed it. And I asked him then why he bothered bringing it home at all and why we had it hung up still somewhere in the gaff. And it, you know, it's made its way down off the wall since.
I actually have a signed Celtic shirt from Damien Duff, so maybe we can reunite them at some point.
Right, well, after the Dream Team nonsense of a couple of pods ago, arguably the worst podcast topic ever recorded, we had to move on to a more legitimate topic today, and we're going back to another historic one, right to the first time an Irish team was involved in a European Cup match. It's Shamrock Rovers versus the Busby Babes from 1957. What we might start off with is just a brief background on each of these teams, so I'm sure anyone listening who knows anything... A
brief background on each of these teams.
Well, yeah.
One of them might be well known.
Well, that's what I was going to say. To just, you know, there could be people new to football who aren't in any way historians who might have just this year started following the League of Ireland. So If you don't know the Busby Babes, which of course you should, Manchester United team in the late 40s and 50s, made up largely of sort of youth players that had progressed under Matt Busby, eight of whom died in the Munich air disaster flying back from a clash with Red Star Belgrade only about 5 months after this very game. So,
say it the Serbian way.
I cannot do so. Along with 15 other people on the flight, it was eight players who died, I should mention as well. McDermott, in terms of Shamrock Rovers at that time, they'd have been, under Paddy Coad, really enjoying quite extraordinary success for a sort of substantial period of this time, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they won the league in 56, 57 and 58, 59. They also won the FAI Cup in 55 and 56 as well. The League of Iron Shield, which is equivalent to the League Cup at the time, they won 56, 57 and 57, 58. So yeah, it's a storied Shamrock Rovers side that many people from, saw them play in that era can kind of list that team. They were very successful.
Is there an element that they're probably not coming to an end of it? Maybe they are coming to a bit of an end in an era, because Coad departs a couple of years after this, but they did win, was it two of their three league titles under Paddy? They won them kind of either side of this year.
Yeah.
So I wonder, is it more of an end of an era? It probably isn't. It's probably just as they're getting to their peak, really.
Yeah, it was more nearly a new era, but players like Paddy Ambrose, Liam Toohey were part of that team, and they're
Paddy player, himself, of course. Paddy
yeah, Paddy. And they're players that would stand out and stand the test of time when people talk about the best players ever at Shamrock Rovers. They'll list plenty of players from the same, Paddy Coad included.
Mm. And just to add to the sort of style they would have been playing, or what their counterparts would have thought of them. So there's a really good piece by Dan McDonnell. Again, as usual, he always has interesting pieces around this kind of thing. But it was more the one of the pieces he lists in it, which is Busby writing in the Evening Chronicle around the time of this game. So he'd come over scouting Shamrock Rovers, and he says on them, it is to our advantage that the Shamrock Rovers players put the emphasis on good football all the time. That's the kind of team United usually do best against, which is a crazy thing to read when you're thinking about a League of Ireland team coming up against a sort of major team, even in England or anywhere, and then being like, it's going to work out for us. They try and play good football. Going to absolutely do them. At the time of this as well, it should be noted that maybe there'd have been a little bit more fear at Shamrock Rovers, because the League of Ireland 11, only I think it was a year before this game, they held the Football League 11 to a 3-3 draw, and around the time, I think Busby actually makes a point in that piece as well, that there would have been seven Shamrock Rovers players in that League of Ireland 11 team, and I think it was four, maybe three, I think it was four of the Manchester United players in the Football League 11. So there'd have been, having generally been thrashed by them for years and years and years before it, and only picked up the odd success here and there against like the Northern Irish or the Welsh sides, they maybe were given quite a little bit more respect, a bit more recognition for what some of these players had already done previously, you know?
Yeah, and the teams would only, that have played, friendlies against one another, but it said this is the very start of the European Cup, and from a Manchester United point of view, they were, other teams were declined or weren't able to, English teams prior to that, to go into the European Cup, but Busby was pretty clear that he wanted to take his team in, and from a Rovers point of view, it was a chance to take on, this famous Manchester United, young Manchester United side with, these young players that were England internationals. And this was in the preliminary round, which was the very first stage of the competition in 57.
And I suppose it's kind of, just for context, I was reading even recently a quote from Eamon Dunphy, who was obviously, he would have grown up in Dublin as a, in awe of the Manchester United and the Busby Babes, and him and John Giles would have signed for Man United around this time. But he kind of spoke that even back then there was kind of an aura around the club and around the team, and even I suppose at that stage in Ireland, I think maybe kind of sometimes a few of us will laugh when somebody goes, why do you support, Bristol Rovers, and they're like, my uncle worked there in the 70s or whatever. But kind of back then it kind of very much was true. It was kind of, places like Manchester or Liverpool or London or whatever were kind of exotic, and when somebody from your family did go over there and maybe didn't come back for a few years, there was kind of a mystical thing about the whole the whole football thing over there, and that's obviously only grown in the recent years, but I thought it was quite interesting that, you know, even back then, even when televised football wasn't really much of a thing, there was still across the Irish Sea, there was still kind of an aura and a kind of a reverence for that team, and even people would be following the results in the newspapers when they don't even see them. So it kind of goes to show how, you know, football has changed but very much stayed the same as well.
Another element to that, actually, when you say football has changed but stayed the same, is Busby further commenting that he felt that United would probably be too quick on and off the ball, essentially, for their opponents. And, you know, essentially it looks like the physicality is the thing that may have sort of got them over the line. In apart from their overall probably better ball playing, they were just a superior sort of unit in terms of physicality and that, you know, as you would expect even today.
Well, that's certainly how the Irish press saw it.
I'm angry, Tony, I have to be honest. Your behaviour was despicable. We do deserve it, yeah. Being robbed during the season with the Dublin City affair. I'm sorry, Tony, but I'm angry as well. I was angry before the game. I've been angry for a long time. And all I can say is, Stephen Kenny, we've won it. So go on, go back to Scotland and get lost. People talk about Stephen Kenny's a nice guy. Don't want people like that in the league. His carry on's been absolutely outrageous.
Very strong words from Stuart Byrne there. Roddy, what do you reckon?
Well, I think he was a bit angry.
The first leg was at Dennymount Park. There's 46,000 or so squeezed into the Phibsborough venue that day. And the final result was 6-0. But Rovers, you know, they had the first chance of the game. Liam Toohey had a chance cleared off the line. And it was 1-0 at half time, and Tommy Taylor got
that's it. They held their own for about 30 minutes, didn't they?
Yeah.
Until they conceded the first.
And then Liam Whelan, there was a few Dublin player had come through at home farm. He got the next two. So it was 3-0 after 57 minutes. And then United then scored three goals in the last 11 minutes of the game. So Taylor, Violet, John, and David Pegg. And just how the Irish press called it. So they said for that first leg, the scoreline is not what you expect to see when Shamrock Rovers play, but then this was a one occasion when the hoops came up against the side of the class of Manchester United. Yet in the end, it was not so much the lack of skill as lack of power and stamina that sent them crashing to such a heavy European defeat. Beaten they were, but not disgraced. Right through a thrill-packed first half, they had every bit as much at play as Matt Busby's Red Devils. And playing against a desperately strong Greaves might have had a goal or two to show for it, but for the shortcomings of the forward line. So that's how the Irish press called the first leg.
You mentioned Liam Whelan there. We should probably talk a fair bit about him, because he's one of those characters that whatever you read about this time and whatever you read about this game, his name constantly comes up. And the main memory, of course, I think you mentioned their home farm player sort of returning and scoring twice at a big club like that. And weirdly enough, in this instance, there would have been a little bit of him proving to the home press that essentially he was good enough, because he's a player, again, we talked about this sort of in the Anne O'Brien podcast right at the very start of doing this. There's a lot of issues that led to him only getting about four international caps. Now, these are often self-created by the football organisation here due to some difficulties in travelling or rules. So there would have been, I think, along that time, you couldn't play an international game on a Sunday had you played on the Saturday for your club. All this kind of carry on, which probably would be known as good practice now, but back then, obviously, not really the case. But yeah, essentially, wouldn't have played for Ireland that much. And I mentioned Dan McDonald's piece at the start of this. He spoke to his brother in his own piece there, Liam Whelan's brother, and just points out that the papers felt he had something to prove. They obviously didn't see him that much, and he massively seems to have proved his worth in that game. And more often, you know, as history's gone on, I mean, you talk about it, wasn't it Bobby Charlton, essentially, was the one who nearly sort of moved him from the team around this time. But not only that, I mean, you're talking about Bobby Charlton, one of the, you know, such a great, great player. And even then, they're kind of saying, yeah, I don't think it was a case of it was time for Liam to move on after Bobby came in. There was a right old battle happening there for that first team spot. So it kind of puts in context what kind of player Liam Whelan was.
Yeah, and I remember my grandfather talking. So Liam Whelan was one of the the player's killed just 4 months later in the plane crash in Munich. And my grandfather telling me about how Dublin stood still the day of the funeral. And Ryan Bailey wrote a really good piece a couple of years ago on the 42. I think Ryan is a distant cousin or a distant relation of Liam Whelan. He spoke to Liam Whelan's two brothers, and it's a really, really good piece. It's available online. I definitely recommend people having a look at it. But there's a really poignant paragraph about the funeral, which I'll just read out. It's hard to imagine how the crowds managed to all congregate on this side of the cemetery as they did for the funeral. One of the grave diggers told the family he had not seen as many people in Glasnevin since the burial of Michael Collins. The pictures, although a little grainy, are staggering. You can see rows and rows of people, men and women, young and old, as the heartbreak felt in Manchester extended to an unprecedented outpouring of grief on the streets of Dublin, the city came to a standstill.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Like, and for a player like that to have been, you know, briefly part of the Republic of Ireland set up and not really be talked about in much plain terms, I suppose that's always going to happen when something like
just
this.
No footage.
Yeah. But you know, reading from the kind of player he was, anyway, there's plenty of descriptions. And it sounds like he was a sort of tricky, agile inside right with lots of sort of swiveling and jinking around. You know, I imagine the old turn on a sixpence phrase would have been used. He seems to have rightly pissed people off when doing it as well. So he seems like he had a bit of that about him where he could, you know, embarrass a player by turning them absolutely inside out. So it is. It's one of those sort of poignant ones to read about the further you go into it, and what a, you know, obviously a loss in a familial sense, a huge loss to the Irish footballing team at that time, even before the death in a way, because not really getting a chance to work him into the team. We should just briefly mention as well, I think I'm right in saying his, I mean, he was only 22 at the time, Liam Whelan, and his strike rate apparently was 52 goals in 96 games.
Yeah, like, which for at the time now was,
absolutely stunning, like, really, really was.
Wasn't really great at the time, was it? What, Dixie Dean get about 60 in four games?
We'll clarify that one on the Dixie Dean podcast we end up doing further down the line. I mean, it's not really a whole lot.
Well, maybe just to talk about the second leg. So the second leg was a much tighter affair, and United went.
I nearly did Shamrock Rovers at the service there.
I was going to let that down. So United went 2-0 up, and you kind of wonder at that stage, would Rovers' heads drop? But Maxi McCann became the first League of Ireland scorer in Europe to make it 3-1, and while United got another goal, Tommy Hamilton got a strike to make it 3-2. And then just how the Irish Independent called it the day after. So without for a moment losing sight of the fact that they lost the tie in aggregate 9-2, Shamrock Rovers nevertheless emerged from their European Cup engagement against Manchester United with full credit. In both games, they concentrated on playing football, and I believe the 3-2 defeat at Old Trafford was a truer reflection of their merits than the 6-0 crushing defeat at Dalymount, for which the strain of playing against such a strong wind and turning over virtually without respite was greatly responsible. They are to be commended on bringing Irish soccer into this important event, and it is to be hoped that this precedent will be followed, and it did. Obviously, it's been the mainstay of the League of Ireland season, the chance for clubs to pit themselves against the teams around Europe. But for Rovers to come up against the calibre of a Manchester United, it doesn't happen very often.
Historic Manchester United team.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that's why the match resonates with people, because it was the first League of Ireland game, because it was against the Busby Babes, because later on in the competition, there was the plane crash in Munich. Yeah. That, you know.
On that second leg, what do you think was, you know, gave credence to their sort of improved fortunes on the pitch in terms of scoring? Like, I wonder, is it an element, and I could be wading into muddy waters here because we don't actually know, so it's all conjecture and guesswork, but it's fun to do a little bit of that. Better conditions, better pitch, maybe home side needing to look dominant, which at the start they're saying they prefer to play against teams that, you know, maybe the Bulls. Was it maybe a bit of complacency given that they were 8-0 up?
Yeah, I'd say there was certainly probably a little bit of United throttling back on it, you know. So, yeah.
Maybe an element of that, but, maybe, you know, at the same time, there's still an unbelievable team in there that nearly had that did have a wobble in the second leg, nearly struggled to do the job. Well, I mean, the comeback was never on, but at the end of the day,
lost the game, it wouldn't really matter.
Well, it still would have been very, very important. I mean, you look again, would have been very, very important to Shamrock Rovers.
Well, I will refer you to the rules of the competition, which are in the first leg. So the three important rules of the European Cup competition are listed on in the match programme from the first leg. So one, no replacement of players allowed, so no substitutions. No extra time. We're obviously really upset about that. Really just didn't appreciate us back then, you know. Yeah. And three, when a series of two games, home and away, results in a win and a defeat for each side, the qualifying team will be decided on goal average. If this goal average is the same for both teams, or if the games result in draws, then a third match will be played on neutral ground. But they never got a chance to play that match on neutral ground.
On that second leg.
And just if you were into the excursion to Waterford v Shamrock Rovers, there's a fast diesel train leaving Weston Row on Sunday, 29th September at 11 a.m. Fare is, I don't understand what that fare is. What's that like? What's that? 17
shillings?
I don't know. Tickets are at Milltown or your local CIE office.